Welcome to another episode of For the Medical Record with your hosts. I am Antoine Johnson.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And we are both postdoctoral fellows at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of the History of Medicine and the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine, which sponsors this podcast. On today's episode, we had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Lan Lee, who is an assistant professor here at Johns Hopkins University in the Department of the History of Medicine. Dr. Lee received their PhD in history, anthropology, and science technology and society studies. That's a lot, but bear with us, from MIT, and also served as a presidential scholar in society and neuroscience at Columbia University before joining the medical humanities program and department of history at Rice University. Dr. Lee was the PI for the Medicine, Race, and Democracy Lab in Medical Humanities at Rice University.
So in this conversation, we really talked to Lan about using so many different formats and so many different mediums to disseminate research in a really effective and democratic way, whether that's podcasts, shout out to us doing a podcast.
Yay.
Whether that's podcasts, films, a lab like Medicine, Race, and Democracy, it's really impressive how Lan utilizes all of their skills and all of these different really creative ways to think through and about the medical humanities and medicine and society and medicine and history. In this conversation with Lan, we also think through how to take your work seriously without taking yourself too seriously. And we also talk about the embodied experiences of being a patient, of understanding yourself as a historian of medicine and how your scholarly work can influence your life and vice versa. So it's a really personal conversation. I'm really glad that Lan shared it with us.
Agreed.
But anyway, we hope that you enjoy listening to this conversation, and we'll link in the show notes to some of Lan's work and to some of the scholars that they mention. And yeah, we really hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, make sure you take notes on Dr. Lee's definition of the medical humanities and compared with all of the other definitions that our guests provide.
There'll be a quiz at the end of the podcast series. Yep.
Winner might receive a free copy of Dr. Lee's book or one of our other guests.
We're just making stuff up now. It's great.
Yay, yay.
Oh, hello.
Welcome to For the Medical Record. We're so happy to have you.
Very excited to be on the record for the medical record.
No, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
I'll just kick off with the first question. Could you tell us more about how you came to work here at Hopkins in the history of medicine and with the Center for Medical Humanities? You know, so how did you become interested in histories of health, medicine, and the body? How did you get here?
Yeah, how did I get here? Oh my gosh. I mean, this is such a huge question because I never thought that I would ever be here. I think it's not so much that hindsight is 20/20. It's just that I was a really poor history student in high school. I got C's in my history classes. I don't identify myself as a stellar student. I spent a lot of time tinkering with things. I was making like earrings out of scrap material, and I like building things. And I think I only became interested in school because I was on a scholarship. I was on a Pell Grant for college, and I didn't want to waste that opportunity, I think. I really fell into history of science. Was like a bio major, wanted to be a neuroscience major, worked in an HIV lab, didn't have the greatest experience. And then I had all these questions about why we were doing the work we were doing. Why were we all studying this one like cell line and asking the same questions? And it really struck me that scientific practice was so mundane. So everything was kind of accidental and serendipitous. I didn't know that history of science was a field of study. I didn't know that history of medicine was a field of study, right? And when I graduated from college, I freelanced as a filmmaker for a while. I applied to grad school because the narrative that I usually go with is that I went to grad school for my parents because I saw my dad struggle in grad school. I saw him struggle as a non-native English speaker, as an immigrant, as someone who's working on a topic that, I mean, he was a scholar of gamelan music, of Indonesian music. And he was told by other faculty of color, scholars of color, that as a scholar from China, no one would expect him to know things other than China. And so I remember hearing him telling that story actually not too long ago. And I was I think it really framed a lot of my own path, which was basically not really knowing what I was doing, but I knew why I wanted to do it. Like, I wanted to finish grad school so that I could get a PhD because my dad struggled so much with it. And I was like, I can do this. But the way that I approach history of medicine is as a child of artists. And so that shapes how I think about different questions. It allows me to be creative. And because I was a non-traditional student in the sense that I wasn't a really stellar student, I don't always follow rules in the same way. I don't really take myself that seriously as a scholar. I don't take myself seriously. I take my work seriously, but I don't always take myself seriously because I see that performance as a form of gatekeeping that tends to overshadow excitement, like just being excited about the work that you're doing with the questions that you have. So how did I arrive at Hopkins? It's like a long and windy path, because I remember towards the end of grad school, I felt like I was, the way I described it to one of my mentors was, I felt like I was fast approaching a cliff and I couldn't see what was on the other side. And I knew that I had to land somewhere. And he sent me an announcement for a postdoc. And when I applied for writing fellowships in my fifth year of grad school, I didn't get any writing fellowships, but I did get the postdoc. So I had to graduate. And that was an incredible experience. It was an interdisciplinary postdoc at Columbia in their Presidential Scholars in the Society and Neuroscience program. And that placed scholars of the humanities and scholars of the sciences in fields that were not their home fields. So as a historian, I was working in a lab. I chose a touch lab to work in because of my work in acupuncture. And I also ended up in a mitochondria lab because the PI was interested in questions of energy and chi. And we just read books on philosophy of mind together. Our primary job was to organize events and to bring different communities at Columbia together. So that allowed me to just do stuff. So I started making small exhibitions, podcast series, short film series. I attached myself to a weaving workshop and just, again, was fast approaching a cliff because postdocing is this limbo period of, I have this degree, but I don't have permanence. It's a particular kind of unsettling feeling of being a postdoc that I think sits in your chest that you can't really swallow. Like that was kind of my feeling. And so as the postdoc ended, it was another fast approaching cliff. And by that point, I had my training in science studies. I had more practical experiences working in a lab. I had started organizing all these events. I was working on my book manuscript for hours every day, and I had submitted the proposal, got it accepted, but I didn't have a job yet. And my backup plan was to start a media company. I was like, I'll do stuff. I can do something. And at that point, medical humanities for me was a new field, but I didn't realize that it was also the only field in which I was most qualified for as someone who did digital humanities and history of medicine and worked with practitioners. So the two jobs that I got when I was on the job market were in medical humanities. And then when I was at Rice, that was a field that I really kind of relished. And then I started really missing being a historian. So this job at Hopkins, when it came up, it's like my dream job in every single way. So that's how I got here.
I can relate, being a shitty high school and early undergrad student. Yep. Like, I hated history, like hated. Because in Oakland, like the Oakland Unified School, all we remember was names and dates. And so yeah. Yep. I thought, oh, this yep. is history? Oh, I'm okay. I don't ever want to do this.
And see, I loved history in high school. And then I got to college and took a history course and hated it for exactly that reason. Mm. So art history was my way into historical thinking. And I found it much more compelling, and it engaged me much more when I was dealing with objects and images, which I know you do too, Lan. But that was my way into liking history again, mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. through actual objects. So yeah, everyone has their own way into it.
Right.
Way of rekindling the
yep.
the fire for it, I guess.
But you have mentioned, you know, your work with physicians and specifically your work in acupuncture. We wanted to learn more about, you know, your journey into doing work in and with acupuncture and its relation to how you became, you know, a historian of the body.
A lot of that comes from when I started my major as a historian of science. There were no classes available on histories of science that were non-European. And so I thought I was going to be a Darwinist. I was like, Darwin is so cool. and I studied abroad. I went to UCL for a semester. I chose to focus on history of medicine in China, in part because I wanted to see my grandparents in China. I wanted to find a way to go to Beijing and like check out the archives, check out materials there. The naive, the kind of the inchoate phase of my research questions were about East-West integration. It was still working on this binary of like, how can these different medical systems talk to each other? And that has kind of spiraled into interest in integrative medicine. There are centers for integrative health. When I was in grad school, there was a teaching hospital at Brigham and Women's that had an integrative clinic. And so I went to the clinic and I asked them if I could make a short film about them to learn about their clinic and also offer them a gift that was more of a trailer so that people could see what they were doing. Because when I was freelancing after undergrad, I was mostly making short commercials or recap videos for conferences. One of my clients was my alma mater, Barnard, and they had these conferences in South Africa, in Johannesburg, in Sao Paulo, in Mumbai. And I would travel with those conferences. And when I arrived at Mumbai or Sao Paulo, or at a certain point, they also went to Shanghai, I would try to contact local clinics and local physicians to learn more about their work and also make a film for them about them. I see filmmaking as a form of gift giving. And I tried to also use it as a way to represent practices in a non-oriental way. Because my family is a family of artists and musicians, I'm really sensitive to soundtracks and to different orientalist tropes. And I see orientalist tropes being employed strategically. Like, there is a kind of performativity of otherness that in a way is required as a form of cultural currency. So I've played that role, but I wanted to pivot to see, to reimagine that, especially for other practitioners too. So that's kind of how my way into working with practitioners. And then my scholarly work was taking that a step further because I wanted to understand, well, we have a lot of really incredible foundational scholarship in STS related to representation, related to objectivity, related to different kinds of visual material. What would that scholarship look like if we applied it or brought in material that is operating on a completely different context or circumstance? And so in my case, it's, what are these graphic images of the body when it comes to meridian maps? What are they doing? How do they facilitate forms of translation? How do they inhibit forms of transformation, translation, and what do they offer us in terms of understanding the ontology of the body? We have all these invisible things in the form of paths, and they manifest in the clinic when acupuncturists needle at specific sites or palpate and try to read different organs or access different depths of the body. So those are just kind of the two kinds of methods that I'm using.
I've got a lot of things swimming around in my brain here, but there are two main paths that I want to branch off into from the answer you just gave. And one is about being a filmmaker, and one is about your work on your book, Body Maps, which you kind of mentioned just then. But I want to ask about filmmaking first. I love the idea of being a filmmaker as giving a gift, like filmmaking as gift giving. I find that it's a really compelling parallel. I can see what you mean there in terms of the output. And then you also spoke about how that squares with your scholarly persona. But I'm wondering if there are, and I could be totally off base with this, but does filmmaking ever complicate or come into conflict with your identity as a scholar? Like, how do you square those two sides of yourself? Talked about being creative and tinkering with things. How do you make sure that your scholarly identity and your filmmaking identity are working with one another to make sure that your praxis is, like, you know, as exciting and as impactful as you want it to be?
Thank you so much for that question. I mean, when I applied to grad school, I wanted to find places where faculty are already making films. I wanted to work with people who understood what it meant to move across media. And at MIT, there are a few faculty already making films. One of them was Chris Wally and Chris Bobel. They're a team of filmmakers. Chris Wally is an anthropologist, and she had this film that came out called Exit Zero, which is about post-industrial Chicago. It's a documentary about her family. And that was actually the first really serious film class I took, was with Chris Wally and Chris Bobel, which was called, like, Documenting Science on Film. And we learned lighting. We watched all sorts of documentaries. It was all about practice. We learned about sensory ethnography. We rented out mics. We went into the field. And for me, I don't see any conflict between filmmaking and scholarly work, because if anything, it forces you to look more closely, and it forces you to work meticulously. And making a documentary is so hard. I mean, and writing a paper, also really hard. Working on a film is a different kind of challenge depending on how much material you have. And it's also physically exhausting, crouching in a corner, following different objects with your camera obscura, with your lens eye. And what I love about filmmaking is that it grounds the body in a kind of technical practice. Like, it's not like I'm an armchair philosopher, right? I'm squatting in the corner. My ankles are hurting. My feet are hurting. I'm the cyborg and I'm thinking about the ethics of my gaze. I'm thinking about the sensitivity of my relationship to patients, with physicians. I'm thinking about representation. And I'm sensitive also to my kind of presence in the space as a somewhat like non-threatening Asian person. There are people like with big cameras, and my style tends to be less, in part because I don't want to carry too much stuff that's like super heavy, because I'm doing everything. I'm doing sound and I'm doing the video, and that's not necessarily the most efficient way to work long term. That embodiment of being a technician is so important, because then you see other forms of labor in academia or that allow an institution to thrive that is just that. There are these like really important technical roles, staff, administrative, bureaucratic, like all of that labor is hard. And so it allows me to see that and just be more present. And then the other side of being a filmmaker is the way that I approach my slides when I give talks. And I'd taken a class with Hisa Kiriyama, who was all about reimagining slides. And we spent a whole semester just making a 3-minute presentation. And it allows me to think about scenes in my talks. How am I going to craft an argument over that arc of this one scene? And it's a similar graphic principle, visual principle, but it helps me think with a different kind of toolkit and with a different level of clarity, because I know where I want to end. It's a bit messy getting there, but if anything, being a filmmaker helps so much more when I use that connection intentionally.
You literally stole the word out of my mouth. I was going to say, this all seems intentional and I love it. I will say it makes both of us excited to read your book once it's published.
So excited.
And it's,
Man, thanks. That's a hard road. That's a real hard road. Yeah.
And just, you know, speaking of which, can you please tell us more about the forthcoming book titled, I'm not sure if it's tentative or if it's, the official title, Body Maps, Improvising Meridians and Nerves in Global Chinese Medicine.
Yeah, I mean, so the book Body Maps, it used to be called Intimate Cartographies. I had a really hard time with the title. And one of my really good friends, Amy Johnson from grad school, trying to go through titles, and she told me to try to come up with bad titles. So I had like Line Over Matter. Then I had Intimate Cartographies, and now I've got Body Maps. But Body Maps is, it's a contemplation of body cartography, especially looking at the convergence of acupuncture atlases or meridian maps and neurophysiology, neurophysiological graphic representations. And the main thrust of the book is bringing in this big elephant in the room for me, which is what happens when physicians, when scholars start to layer maps on top of each other that are of different graphic genres, because they represent different kinds of things. They ask different kinds of questions. They assume different ontologies of the body. And when it comes to something like meridian maps or neurophysiological maps, they only exist in these kind of hand-drawn improvised maps. And I'm using improvisation in the sense that when you have a hand-drawn map, there's so many things that you have to kind of consider in where that pen moves or where that brush moves. And when you look at, for instance, neurophysiological anatomical structures or prints, there are all these kind of curves that you see in nerves, and then they've got all these like lines on top of them and like all these random symbols, seemingly like cryptic symbols. It's this imagination of nerves unfurling, and yet it's taken for granted as a truth to life kind of representation, but it's fantastical in a way. When it comes to meridian maps or meridian tu, and tu is a graphic genre that's central to the book because it's a technical image in which meridians live. They only live in tu. They only live in hand-drawn maps. You don't see them in fluorescent dyes. You don't see them in CT scans. You don't see them in MRI scans. They don't register on any other technological form of representation. You can't see them with photographs. They only represent in these hand-drawn images, and they have an incredible longevity. They're images that date back to full atlases that date back to around the 13th century, but that date is the date of its reproduction. We don't have dates for its origin. There are sculptures of paths from archaeological sites. They are old. These images are really old. And I find that really fascinating. I don't assume that they're transhistorical in any way. And yet they have a longevity that allows you to track how people have interpreted them, modified them, manipulated them. And one of the hidden histories here is that acupuncture anesthesia, which was a practice that emerged in the 1950s, 1970s, based on needling and inducing localized numbness, that gave rise to new neurophysiological theories of pain. So the reason why it's called Global Chinese Medicine is because it travels a lot. It's using primary sources in Chinese, Japanese, Latin, Dutch, and secondary sources in English, Chinese, Japanese, French, German. You see a really wide kind of footprint of where these images end up. So that's the gist of the book. And every chapter contemplates or rests on a certain set of images.
We can talk for so long. Oh, man, I'm just fascinated. I'll pass it to Christy.
No, it's really fascinating. I've got four questions that I've written down, which is maybe a little bit too much for just, you know,
She'll synthesize them.
I'll try to synthesize them. And, you know, you were kind enough to share a bit of your manuscript with us as well, which was just so much fun to read. But you talk about these anatomical images, these body images as maps. And of course, I couldn't help but connect that to this podcast's logo, which is actually, it's an anatomical drawing by Max Braidell, who was based at Johns Hopkins. And he founded the Artists Applied to Medicine department right across the street from us here. But when we were working with the graphic designers here on this logo, and they presented us with this amazing zoomed in image of Max Braidell's drawing of the inner ear, Antoine and I were talking about how it looked like a map.
Of all things.
It looked like, you know, this eschewing of all the context of it, the actual lines and the structure of it. It wasn't so different from how we would perceive of a historical map. So I thought that was really interesting. And of course, you know, the reason that we have that drawing as our logo is because it is the inner ear. And so as a podcast, an auditory medium for disseminating research and disseminating knowledge, it worked really well.
That's amazing.
But I maybe wanted to talk a little bit about, in the answer to the first question, you talked about some pretty personal reasons for going into the research and going into the jobs that you did. And I know you and I before have talked about actually going to acupuncture and speaking to these practitioners. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about like the lived experience of undergoing acupuncture, of undertaking those procedures. I don't know if they're called procedures, but those appointments, I guess, and how that feeds into the way that you think about your work. Are you now like an embodied historian of the body because you are, you know, doing the things that you write about? How does that work, and how do they play into each other?
Thanks so much for that question. I should say, okay, how should I start this? So I've been working with physicians for a long time. And when I work with them closely, sometimes they make casual observations. This Ayurvedic physician would look at my nails and say, oh, Lan, I can see you're overworked. Your nail bridges are very obvious. And I was like, thank you for reading into my body without like, but I mean, but we're good friends. But it's also this kind of idea that your body is speaking in all sorts of ways. And so when I would work with physicians, they would always want to ask me to come into the clinic. And I would say, no, I'm okay. Like I'm a long time kind of practitioner of Qigong. Like I grew up with it. I've always wanted to understand my own body on my own terms. My excuse is that I don't like people touching me. But because I work so much with Chinese medical theory, I knew for a long time that something was off. So for me, I have this chapter in the Routledge History of Emotions that came out about spleens and overthinking as an emotion. And when I was in grad school, I would wake up at night, like at 2 or 3 in the morning, like paralyzed with anxiety. And it was like the sky was falling. Like, I'm never going to finish my dissertation. I have to go in by 8 a.m. I have to do all these things. And I knew that was an issue with my spleen. For me, at least from the stuff that I read, I was like, this pattern of what we might describe as insomnia for me was a sign that something was off, overthinking. And as I think COVID intensified the burnout of overworking, overthinking, trying to learn how to obviously teach online within a really constrained social environment. And then when I got this job, I was so exhausted. And I remember thinking, what if I can't do this job because I'm just physically unwell? Like I can't. And so I was talking to my therapist and I was like, what's acceptable for me is acupuncture. But by that point, I had been working with the American College of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine in Houston, and I understood how they train their students. And it was something that really resonated with me because what I was really critical of is this kind of code switching that happens where sometimes you would meet an acupuncturist or someone who is a medical practitioner who says really casually, oh, qi doesn't exist. Let's explain away all these kind of like cosmological elements that are central to this kind of medical practice. And I'd be like, okay, cool. Like I see that as a kind of, as a strategic move because you want to engage with biomedicine and you want to live in a biomedical cosmology and there's a denial of pluralism or plural cosmologies. I get that. But I wanted to work with a school that spoke a language that I felt comfortable in and that I was fluent in. So when I arrived at the college and I explained all my symptoms, I also mentioned waking up at night and I knew something was wrong with my spleen and they palpated me and they were like, okay, it's your spleen stomach. And I was like, I knew it. I know what's wrong. I just don't know. Can you like help me? Can you just help me? And because I knew how to be a patient, because I spoke that same language, because I knew what to feel for, and I would ask them, oh, what site is this? What site does that do? I know that bodies are changing over time. I know that these pads are moving. What's the name? Can we excavate? This is all just to say that I feel like I'm a pretty good patient, because I go in and I'm not like asking, how does it work? And I'm not saying things like, is it just placebo? Like, I don't go in with all this other kind of baggage. I go in with, okay, what's the site doing? That's so cool. I can feel the needle doing this, this, and that. And sometimes I would be on the therapy table and the needle would go in and my calf would like vibrate. I'd be like, oh, you got the Duo Qi. And then the acupuncturist would be like, how do you know about Duo Qi? And I'm like, because I study this. And this is not to say, of course, there are many historians of medicine, especially Chinese medicine, who are practitioners themselves, who train as practitioners. So they come into this with a highly technical understanding. And I had tried to resist going to acupuncture school because I wanted to understand the landscape of the inculcation, the landscape of how people were being trained before I dedicated myself to a single school, because it felt like that would corner me, because I would be speaking the language of that school, because I would buy into that cosmology or buy into that approach. And so I never trained, but I was familiar with the language.
It's really interesting that you say that you're a good patient, because I feel like I've heard other historians of medicine say that studying this kind of thing makes them not great patients, because you're either overanalyzing it or, you know, for various reasons. Do you know what I mean?
No, I do.
Yeah.
I have a story which is going to turn into a book or an article as well. But no, seriously, when my son was born, he had high levels of jaundice and they had to put him under that light to try to get out of the system. And the nurse made a comment, you know, trying to calm us down because I was the one panicking more so than mom, who just had gave birth. And the nurse said, oh, don't worry. You know, African-Americans typically have high levels of jaundice. And I was just like, as someone studying racism in medicine, I was just like, here we go. And I just joked with, I'm like, you know, how are you defining African-American?
Yeah.
Like, and then my partner, she's Vietnamese. So I'm like, is it, you know, the African-American side or the Vietnamese side that's giving him the jaundice? Like, how do you know? You know?
That story is really interesting juxtaposed to Lan's, because what does good patient actually mean? That could be defined in so many ways. So yeah, I really appreciate you talking about that and your own experiences of feeling into your own body and how your work helps you to do that, or helps you to have the vocabulary for it, really. And I'm wondering, I went to a whole conference on interoception a while back, like this idea that you could feel the processes within your body. But I'm wondering, do you write or think about this concept of interoception, like being able to feel your spleen literally? Because I don't think I know what that feels like, because I, you know, I don't have the vocabulary or the scope of feeling for that.
I mean, that's so important. I mean, when I came out of grad school, I found it really hard to talk about anything. I found it really hard to be in my own body. It was really hard for me to even say that I worked on Chinese medicine, because I had deconstructed it so thoroughly. And in acupuncture, the word is, I mean, it's historically contingent. It's stuck in Latin. Acu was just needle. Puncture is puncture. You're just poking people with a needle when it comes to acupuncture, just the word itself. It took me in my postdoc to undo a lot of that kind of stuckness, where I couldn't talk about medical practice as a practice. And it took me, I think, being a patient to at least find a space that I trusted, because I knew that was super important. I wanted to be in a clinic that was diverse. I wanted to be in a clinic that understood, or that didn't have the same kinds of like post-colonial insecurities. I mean, that erased a lot of the language that I think for me anchored part of Chinese medical cosmology or East Asian medical cosmology. And I think in terms of interoception, there's also a suspense of disbelief. One of the reasons why I am a historian of the body is because the body is inherently opaque. Like, I haven't seen my brain. Doesn't mean it's not there. I haven't seen my kidneys, but I can feel it kind of when my back aches. I don't know how long my large intestine is. Does that matter? And so there's a kind of play when it comes to being in a body that you can't always know fully. So when I'm in these spaces, when I'm working with texts, historical sources, or if I'm in a clinic, either talking to physicians or just going just for myself as a patient, I think I'm really good at this point of with suspending disbelief, where I can have in the back of my head all this stuff running, back end critique running. And then on the other hand, it's kind of like, this is a role that I will play for now because I need to get better. And these are the conditions under which I'm okay with getting better in. Like, I find clinics and again, physicians that I trust. But it took years to find that. And also, Antoine, what you mentioned about these racist microaggressions that are coded in the language of public health, that does a kind of damage that we weather. And I feel protected in spaces that already are subaltern. Again, my acupuncturist is not a mainstream practitioner. He probably has a lot of people who don't really know what he's doing, and he doesn't always tell them because he doesn't assume that they would understand. Maybe he will just palpate them because he wants to see what's happening in their body. And that's a space where the kind of suspense of disbelief is a little bit less about being guarded and more about, I really don't know, can you please help me? And I'm okay with X, Y, and Z forms of treatment. I'm okay with food as treatment. I'm okay with herbs. I'm okay with like these kinds of supplements. I will still get my vaccines. Like there is a kind of performativity of being a good biomedical biopolity that I engage in. So that's the dance.
That was my favorite response to any of the questions. So Christy and I, we were over here, you know, combing through your CV and everything. And something that just stands out to us a lot is the different mediums that you use for disseminating your work, especially, you know, being a PI for the Medicine, Race, and Democracy Lab at Rice University. And Christy and I, we always talk about public facing work and doing things that aren't behind paywall. So we'd like to hear about your work in exhibitions, podcasts, anything else. You know, could you tell us about this work, methods, and how they have facilitated your thinking, visual, auditory, or otherwise?
The Medicine Race Democracy Lab was another accident, and I think a really valuable one. Before the MRD lab, I had started another small collective called the Digital Oncology Initiative. And I started that at the beginning of COVID for students. There was a lot of back-end conversation among faculty of how to support maybe Asian American students who were receiving a lot of anti-Asian hate, or students who were really negatively impacted by having internships canceled. And there was one conversation where one faculty suggested that rather than putting up a disclaimer, we stand with X, Y, and Z, just to reach out to individual students, see if they're okay. So I reached out to one student who was in the first class I taught at Rice, who had in the course of that class talked about their own health issues, being a scholarship student. And I reached out and I said, are you okay? How's your internship going? And they said, I don't know what to do. So I had some research funds at the time, and I thought, I can create something. Like, I can create opportunities. I have financial means through Rice. We spent a summer analyzing scientific articles related to Chinese medicine and cancer, and it was a long learning process. And I told my students, I was like, well, why don't we also have a front-facing version of this, where we have this back-end research that will take a lot of time, but we can have a storytelling component. That's something that I know how to do, and we can train you in. I had edited my own audio. My friend Alex Ragmorley and I created Metaphors of the Mind. I did a lot of the recording and the editing. I'd never trained someone else to hear themselves differently. And so that was the beginning of what would later become the MRD lab. I never thought that I would be running a lab, but I had seen it done when I was a postdoc. And so for the MRD lab, it was the first time that I had run a meeting with students. It was the first time that I had created an agenda that was also founded in collaboration with writers and poets and hospitalists. The challenge was getting medical students involved. That was one of the goals. So a lot of the students were all undergrads. And in terms of the media, that was the beauty of medical humanities, is that I would ask them, what do you want the output to be? Do you want it to be poetry? Do you want to make films? We can do podcasts if that makes sense. We can write essays. And I was also working with a close colleague of mine, Pierce Alguero. We were putting together a series of essays for his project on global Buddhist medicine called the Jivaka Project. And I was watching how he would work with students, training them as researchers, editing their short essays and articles, and then refining something that they had created and that they could also share. So it was a lot of scaffolding in terms of the media, but a lot of it, like none of it would have happened if COVID hadn't happened and if that hadn't kind of precipitated this need to reach out to students and create something that was student-centered, which is something that I already believe in, but I just had never done it before.
I'll first of all say that, I mean, kudos, because that is exactly what people in permanent positions should be doing, creatively thinking about hands-on mm-hmm. and really truly helpful, not just virtue signaling ways to advocate mm-hmm. for students, for, you know, people in more precarious situations, whether mentally, physically, financially, or in terms of their employment. I hope that that kind of structure of that lab can be inspiration to other people who perhaps aren't used to having that kind of hands-on mm-hmm. interaction. So yeah, I just wanted to say thanks for that. Also, you know, it's good inspiration for Anton and I. Like, we can use these kind of frameworks, as you said, scaffolding, to think through how really to best serve our students through different ways of research dissemination, through different ways of setting up opportunities for them, et cetera. I also just wanted to say that like this tracks really perfectly into the conversations about what the medical humanities actually are. In this podcast, thinking about the word lab as something that's so coded hard sciences and research outputs that's just data and, you know, biology, chemistry, et cetera. So I think using frameworks and using the language like that is really helpful for thinking about medical humanities outputs as valuable, as concrete, and as kind of change making and world building, community building, et cetera. So yeah, that's just me saying lots of appreciation for you and what you're doing.
Right. Same here. Lan, I just want to say I do empathize with you in the struggle of involving medical students. You know, they have such strict schedules. But pivoting back to the medical humanities, diving deeper into, you know, some questions about you, your work, and especially as a scholar, and us being here at the Center for Medical Humanities and Social Medicine, we are curious, personally, what do the medical humanities mean to you? What value do you see that they bring to society, to the academy, in the classroom? And even more specifically, what are the medical humanities to you? Mm-hmm. So really just continuing to pick your brain on how you are inverting, you know, these terms like acupuncture, you know, if there's a way that you're reframing how we think of the medical humanities.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I should say a couple of things about the spirit of the MRD lab. We are talking about labs, and labs are modeled after industrial processes and exploitative labor. Like there are hierarchies built in so that technicians do a lot of the work, right? So what I see in terms of just a humanities lab is that it's supposed to be collaborative and it's supposed to have mentorship built in. And I think that's really important. The lab itself is an invitation. And when I talk about it to medical students or if I give talks for residents, I did have like one success case or one resident came up to me and was like, can I do something? Can I create something? And we did over the course of, I think, 7 to 8 months. It takes a lot of time. And that the lab itself, because of its funding, has supported at least like 30 students, which is, I mean, just in terms of long-term mentorship, I think is really important. So medical humanities or health humanities or medicine, science, and humanities, the MSH program at Hopkins, it can do a lot. From what I understand, the field does come out of literary scholars. You have scholars working in narrative medicine, trying to engage with physicians and storytelling. There is an element of medical humanities for pre-meds to ask really basic questions about burnout, about race. And it's just a window in. It allows them to be even the slightest bit critical of their own practice. Why is it that as pre-meds, they have to learn STEM when it doesn't teach them how to read a body? It doesn't teach them how to deal with death. It doesn't teach them how to understand the ethics of paternalism. So I think medical humanities is really capacious. There are benefits and weaknesses to that in building any program, because you can lose a lot of the theoretical edge, in the sense that I was not a historian in those spaces. I wasn't a historian of global Chinese medicine. I could talk about acupuncture, and I kind of smuggled acupuncture in, where my goal was to have pre-meds to like think twice about being pre-med, think twice about what kind of processes, what kind of hoops are they jumping through in order to work as cheap labor when they're residents, work in a system that is exploitative, work in a system that asks for you to work be on call for 30 hours at a time and work really grueling hours. And the critique, of course, is that how is it that we have so many doctors who are living such unhealthy lives so early in their career? So those are critical questions to ask. Sometimes pre-med students carry those questions with them when they're still in medical school. And there's a kind of submission that happens when you bend to a system that doesn't change or hasn't shown signs of flexibility. And not to say, again, we are in a school of medicine, and I have a lot of respect for people who serve patients. And the critique that the lab at least offers when I have students, when I send students to shadow interns at the acupuncture college, is that they can see that there are other models of medical education, that there are models of education that are inclusive, that don't discriminate based on age, based on previous education. The college take students as they are and they train them. It is still really grueling because they have modeled it after medical school education. It's 4 years. It's a lot of exams. It's a lot of clinical hours. So it does have a little bit of that biomedical settlement embedded within it, but it is a different kind of model. And I'm not saying that it's like a super successful model, but for me, that's my way into medical humanities is I have a particular goal in mind. It's not one that is grand. It's not one that I'm putting into practice through actively being embedded in the bureaucracy, but it's one that I hope can at least encourage a little bit of a shift in what students assume is possible when they talk about healthcare. That's one of the reasons why the MRD lab was looking at community clinics, was looking at acupuncture clinics, was looking at clinics that were connected to masjids and or mosques that were offering services to communities that may have been overlooked by the Texas Medical Center. That was one of the goals, is like, who are these clinics serving? And they're different populations, just because at the time when I was in Houston, Houston has a really different demography than Baltimore, for instance. So arriving here, I don't know how to read the city yet. And maybe it is through community clinics. Maybe it's through clinics that, for instance, that Jeremy works at.
And just for reference, that's Jeremy Green, who's the chair of the History of Medicine Department. But okay, that was really brilliant, Lan. Thank you so much. That was really helpful for thinking through what the medical humanities can do, which, as we said, is something that this podcast is constantly trying to figure out and get to the heart of, although there will be a million possible answers to that. I also thought this idea of, you know, potential other models or hybrid models or, you know, not typically Western biomedical models of medicine is really helpful. And it reminds me of the episode that I think will have just come out right before we put this episode out with you, is the short colloquium episode based on Aloy Toyin Odunton and Jonathan Roberts' work that plays with that dichotomy between modern and traditional. And like, is that actually a dichotomy or can they be married in much more nuanced and appreciative ways? So yeah, I found that really interesting.
And I just want to say that I appreciate the undercommons approach that you're taking. It's like subversive, you know, in the spirit of Walter Rodney with the guerrilla intellectual, being in grounding yourself with the community and utilizing the campus resources for those in the cities in which universities reside. But, you know, speaking of those folks, we are curious, who are some scholars who have vitally influenced your work within the medical humanities / history of science / history of medicine?
That's a really hard question, because I'm still building a bibliography or reading list that I wish I had as a grad student. And so that list is still growing. And so I'm both a digital humanities lead and a postdoc fellow at the Center for Black, Brown, and Queer Studies. And we have weekly meetings and we have weekly colloquium, and I'm learning so much and reading so much. So even thinking about Chile Membe's Necropolitics is something that's new for me, because I want to include that. I want to bring that into Chinese studies. I don't know if this is a cop-out, but the scholars who have influenced me the most are people who I'm always reaching out and thinking with and thinking kind of in conversation with. And they just so happen to be my colleagues at Hopkins. I think there's so much incredible work that's happening. Like, huge shout out to Ahmed Ragab, who, when I was a grad student, actually invited me to my first conference presentation. So like, Jeremy, I met him because he was mentoring a lot of my friends in grad school. And then we kind of met again at a conference in China. And I remember he gave a presentation on what the history of medicine is and how it fractures into all these different branches. Just shout outs to everyone in the department. Elizabeth O'Brien's work is incredible. Sasha White's work, groundbreaking. Graham Mooney's work, so creative and thoughtful, especially when it comes to Harm City. I mean, and Nathaniel's work on eugenics has been such a like a longstanding critique of biomedicine. Mary Fissel's work, especially her new book coming out on abortion before Roe, is going to be really, really important. I think the people who I'm thinking with, I'm so grateful that they are the people who I get to work with. And that's just at the School of Medicine. I don't know if I have one person who I keep going back to, but there are people who I just really need to knock on their door and be like, what do you think about this? Does this make sense to you? The obvious starting points for me were historians of medicine, people who I spend a lot of time thinking with, who I read a lot, but I don't have a day-to-day relationship with. It's a long, long, long list, but it's not like I go to my Foucault, you know, it's not that I just like pull up these books where I'm like, let me look through some more Kuhn again. It's not the kind of historiography that I find worth fetishizing. It's just like, who am I thinking with right now?
It's much more relationship-based, which I love, which relates back to your earlier answer about communities and community clinics. So yeah, I really appreciate that. I think that's a really good way of thinking about it. And one last question that we wanted to ask you, which is pretty important to the mission of this podcast overall, is could you tell us how your historical work in the history of medicine can help us to think about the debates, problems, or practices that exist in medicine today?
Yeah, thanks so much for this question. It's a huge question, and there are many, many debates, problems, and practices that I see my work engaging with. And I'm thinking about my work as a cultural historian using a range of methodological tools that has both intellectual goals and social goals. So for instance, with my book, Body Maps, I'm bringing together East Asian studies with STS and methods in art history. And that's meant to understand the role of graphic genre in facilitating and limiting knowledge transmission and translation. So this gets into big themes in the history of science related to objectivity, and it also fills a gap in comparative histories of anatomy. So the book is addressing a number of questions. One of them is what it means to look at and use early modern images of meridians or nerves, which a lot of physicians are doing today. And they use these early modern images to make claims about the body. And by doing so, we can see anatomical illustrations of nervous structures, for instance, as what I call improvisatory, where, you know, hand-drawn means are incorporating accidents and habits of mind. And this is what characterizes graphic genre. And this is also what contemporary physicians tend to overlook. And by offering this comparative transnational history, I want to introduce meridian tool as familiar or as accessible to a non-East Asian audience, and then also offer new intellectual perspectives related to organ ontology. The historical work that I'm doing with the Medicine Race Democracy Lab, which is in collaboration with scholars, artists, writers, and students, this does a different kind of work. So the lab is generating new social histories of medicine, histories of medical professionalization, interview archives, and literary analysis through community clinics. And we started with community clinics in Houston. And so one branch of work that I want to do in the lab is also to lay out a social history of medical professionalization of East Asian medical schools through either a series of articles or short films. Right now we have a series of podcasts, and this work is related to social representation, and I see it going hand in hand with my book manuscript. So the book is just taking a step back and looking at what images are doing in the first place and taking a long history of a comparative history of images and image representation. And then the lab does a different kind of social work that I think is necessary to understand how physicians are being trained now and what are the political histories and social histories related to potentially limits in training and accreditation.
I want to thank you for being so generous with your time.
Yes.
But, you know, lastly, in us being selfish, anticipating this book publication, after that, can you give us a hint about what you're working on next or other works in the pipeline, projects that you are excited about?
Oh, my gosh. So I really want to write an article about either an article or a short film. I haven't decided which one, about history of acupuncture in the U.S. It could be an article. At one point, I really want to make a graphic novel. I really want to create something that's like maybe narrative form. Maybe I was imagining like a graphic walkthrough of a meridian map. You arrive at different sites and you can tell stories about those sites from clinicians, and also kind of compressing that with like historical moments. That's like a dream book. I have a project on numbness, a long history of numbness, and that's a history of food and flavor and sensation and the absence of sensation. It's inspired by acupuncture anesthesia. But those are just the things that are kind of both irons in the fire and also irons I want to throw in the fire. Yeah, just I have tons of dream projects, but those are the three that come to mind right now. And I'm also working on a podcast with Pierce on Buddhist medicine. So that's something that we're doing.
Once again, I love that you just have so many different mediums in which to get your research out there. We've got podcasts, and, you know, Anton and I are both writers, but I feel like it's helpful to have another outlet for it. So yeah, we just want to thank you again for joining us, and we can't wait for everybody else to hear this.
Yes. See you around the department soon.